From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, as the U.S. Senate debates immigration reform, DACA recipients cope with being the center of that debate.
They're talking about it. They're not passing it. It might pass. We're shutting down. It's just a teeter-totter back and forth, and it's very exhausting.
There's just so much that is up in the air, things that people take for granted, their ability to plan their lives. Even that has been taken away from us.
The police view of the push to tighten up Michigan's civil asset forfeiture laws.
The story that's been told is somewhat misleading and one-sided.
And the hospital view on the proposed bill setting nursing staffing and overtime levels.
One size or one set of staffing regulations wouldn't necessarily be applicable to every hospital across the state.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Just what do we do about the dreamers, the hundreds of thousands of young people brought to this country illegally as children by their guardians or parents? The answer to this question still eludes Congress, despite two brief government shutdowns that happened in large part over legislators' inability to agree on a solution. The DACA program, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, has protected young undocumented immigrants brought here as children, protected them from deportation. President Trump terminated this Obama-era program last September, and he set March 5th as a deadline for Congress to do something for the Dreamers. With us now are two people who are waiting to hear what that something is. Julio Mejia Andino, originally from Honduras. He's 27 years old, and his DACA status was just approved again last July. Julio, welcome.
Nice to be here.
And Maria Ibarra Frere is also 27. She was born in Mexico. She got her DACA status in 2012. She's chair of the Washtenaw Immigrant Justice Coalition, and she is a graduate from the University of Michigan Masters of Social Work program. Welcome, Maria.
Thanks for having me.
So it was so not long ago when most Americans did not know what DACA meant. And now DACA dreamers are in the headlines every single day. Maria, what has it been like for you to have your issue so front and center in the national dialogue and political debate?
It's a mix of feelings. It's heartening to see how many people care about this, how much momentum there is. It's also confusing to figure out how it became so big so fast, where I wish this momentum had been as big in 2010 when we were so close to a DREAM Act. And it's also very emotionally exhausting to have things change every other day from potentially something could happen. No, just kidding. It seems like it's all going to derail. So it's a lot of back and forth and a lot of information to keep up with.
And how about from where you sit, Julio?
Every day I check the news just to, because every day is something new with the government. They're talking about it. They're not passing it. It might pass. We're shutting down. It's just a teeter-totter back and forth, and it's very exhausting. Sometimes I talk to my managers, what's my next move going to be at work? Am I still going to be here? You know, on top of that, you got life issues that you got to deal with, bills and stuff. So it's very stressful, but we get by.
We get by. When you stop and you realize that President Trump announced the end of DACA last September 5th, so that's more than 5 months ago. When you heard that news, did you think Congress would have some kind of fix in place by that March 5th deadline?
No. Sadly, like many other undocumented people, are used to false promises and exciting headlines and the possibility of something that you know sounds too good to be true. So it makes me sad to say this, but I didn't think that Congress would come up with a solution. And I don't think they're going to have a solution by March 5th.
Here we have, as the Senate starts this kind of open-ended debate, there is a group of Republican senators who are going to advance their version of the president's immigration proposal. So that would offer a pathway to citizenship for 1.8 million eligible immigrants. But to get that, the White House wants upwards of $25 billion for border security and the wall and deep cuts in family migration and end to the diversity visa lottery.
And the White House wants changes to laws that would make it easier to detain and deport immigrants. As you heard all of this, what did you think of that negotiation?
It's a waste of money. You know, we focus so much on the immigration conversation, but I'm sure that there are millions of families and people in the U.S. who would really benefit from that money that's supposedly going to border security. And I shared this last time, and I still would not accept DACA or the DREAM Act if it came attached to more immigration enforcement in our communities.
Why?
It's not fair to our families, to our parents, to people who have sacrificed everything to get us where we are. And it's also, to accept it would be buying into this rhetoric that somehow undocumented and DACA youth deserve relief or the right to work more than people who don't have DACA. I think it's very divisive. It's a way that has been used in the past to control communities, particularly communities of color. And in the long run, it will just be a Band-Aid solution. But we're going to see this problem reoccurring again. All the people that got here, you know, after DACA, or anyone who was too old by just a couple days who doesn't qualify, it's very unfair to say that they don't deserve the right to live here, the right to work, the right to be safe, simply because they didn't have DACA.
There certainly is the kind of conversation and sometimes rhetoric that we hear. Things are heated. And to that point, White House Chief of Staff John Kelly certainly got the nation's attention when he recently talked about the president's latest immigration proposal. Let's take a listen and we'll talk about it after.
There are 690,000 official DACA registrants. And the president sent over what amounts to be 2.5 times that number, to 1.8 million. The difference between 690 and 1.8 million were the people that some would say were too afraid to sign up, others would say were too lazy to get off their asses, but they didn't sign up.
Maria, what do you want to say to us about General Kelly's comment?
I actually wrote a response to this with my colleague William Lopez called Five Reasons Why John Kelly's Comments Are Wrong on DACA. And to say that they were too lazy just falls into this trope that we hear that immigrants are lazy, and I've never understood how we can steal jobs and be lazy at the same time. And this idea of being afraid, and the first response was that, yes, John Kelly, like, people are afraid, and they have a right to be afraid, as we've seen this administration. First, you have DACA, and then you don't, and then maybe you do, but not really. And when a billion-dollar industry is targeting you for removal and is targeting your family, how can you not be afraid? And the expectation that you don't deserve status and you don't deserve DACA or the DREAM Act or any kind of relief simply because you're afraid is so incredibly cruel.
The comment about being lazy.
For somebody to call me lazy and for a politician to speak like that, this is a person who represents the people. To talk like that, to me, is unacceptable when it comes to being in politics.
Have either of you seen any difference, for better or for worse, in the way that people react now when they realize that you're a dreamer versus before all of this attention began?
Yeah, definitely. Before, people would just think I'm, you know, we love Julio. He's good. He's an awesome kid. But they didn't know that I was undocumented at the time. And now that they know that, you know, I could be sent any moment back to Honduras. And then when they hear that, it's like, wow, your life could change that fast. We didn't know that. We thought you were all set. I still work with people who go, you know, don't think DACA is the greatest thing. I still have to face those things.
You know, it's interesting. I'm watching your expression. You're smiling, but not really.
You have to. You have to. You can't let people see it. See what you're actually going through, what you're feeling. Because then, who knows? You know, people are actually showing the true selves with DACA. They're either against it or with it.
I'm wondering how this uncertainty, Maria, is affecting your life and how you're trying to plan for whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really difficult to have stability. My plan had been to buy a house this year, to start looking to buy a house and put some roots down in Ypsilanti. And I can't do that anymore if I don't have the certainty of an income. It's difficult to just even, you know, make travel plans after my DACA expires. There's just so much that is up in the air, things that people take for granted, their ability to plan their lives. Even that has been taken away from us.
So as you watch all of this unfolding in Congress and you watch the changes from the White House, where on one day, on a Tuesday, the president said, we want a bill that's full of love. We yeah. love the dreamers. And then on Thursday, when you have a Republican senator and a Democratic senator showing up thinking they were going to have a deal and it's tossed out. How do you go through each day?
I stopped paying attention to what's going on. It's a self-protective mechanism. I actually, my go-to response when people ask me how I feel about all of this is I feel nothing. I'm numb. I've blocked all this out. And I occupy myself doing a lot of activism and a lot of immigration work, but none of that directly impacts me.
And if March 5th comes and goes and nothing happens, do you feel that your lives will change, or are you just going to keep on keeping on? What do you think will happen? I know I'm asking you to look ahead into the future a few weeks, but...
I think about it every day. I actually do. What am I going to do? I definitely don't want to go back to riding my bike in the winter because I can't drive, because I'm scared if I get pulled over. I definitely don't want to go back to those days. You know, I definitely want to continue school. I love what I'm doing. I don't want to go back to the way it was.
Maria Ibarra-Frere and Julio Mejia Andino, we want to thank you so much for being here, sharing what you're going through right now, you and so many other dreamers throughout the country. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, we talk about how police in Michigan use the state's civil asset forfeiture laws. That comes up in 10 minutes right here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The State House Judiciary Committee today continues reviewing proposed legislation that would make changes to Michigan's civil asset forfeiture laws. The current laws allow police to take and keep property from people even when those people have not been charged or convicted of a crime. Among other things, the legislation would require a criminal conviction before police could seize property under the civil asset forfeiture process. Last week, we spoke with Jarrett Scarup of the Libertarian-leading Mackinac Center for Public Policy. He supports tighter laws to place more restrictions on the way police departments could seize someone's private property. Today, the police view, as we welcome Bob Stevenson, Executive Director of the Michigan Association of Chiefs of Police. He spent 37 years in police work in Livonia, the last 7 of those years as its police chief. Bob, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you very much, Cynthia, for having me on. I appreciate this opportunity.
Well, tell us how police in Michigan use these civil asset forfeiture laws.
Sure, Cynthia. I think that the story that's been told is somewhat misleading and one-sided. Civil forfeiture came about actually back in the 80s when there was a recognition that the profits from illegal activities were often being retained by the criminals. So as one of the ways to help fight, especially the war on drugs, was to take the profit motive out of it. So police agencies since that time have seized property pursuant to it being used or proceeds from drug trafficking. Unfortunately, the story that's being told is that once this happens, the police are, if you will, the judge, jury, executioner, and once we take this property, that the people have no recourse at all. And that's absolutely untrue. There is full recourse for the people, even up to the requirement that no bond is posted, so they can have their court hearing, if you will, without putting forth any bond requirement.
When we see examples that have been pointed to, for example, the raid in 2008 on the Contemporary Art Institute of Detroit, people at a dance party, a gallery was raided by police who said it didn't have the proper license to hold that party, and 44 people had their cars impounded, and people paid hundreds of dollars to get their cars back, even though they had their loitering tickets dismissed. And there are other stories like that. That doesn't sound like the war on drugs.
No, that's true. There are some complaints that have come from some local ordinance issues, but those are very, very few and far between. This is a much larger issue than that, Cynthia. If this law was to pass in its current form, I don't think people realize what it would be. Here's an example. If the police stop a car driving down the road, and this happens often, that has several hundred thousand dollars packaged in small bills, secreted within a secret compartment in the vehicle, the police would be prohibited from seizing those dollars on the roadway. Now, to think that some point in time later, once you had a conviction, that those assets would be there, I think is beyond common sense. Another example that happens is the police raid a house. Inside the house, they've sent in a confidential informant. We have our buy money inside the house. We get inside the house, all the drugs have been sold, and there are several thousands of dollars, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars, packaging equipment, our buy money that's there, but there's no drugs. The odds of us bringing forth a criminal prosecution in that instance are slim and none. Do we clearly want to let the people retain the funds that they got? I don't think so.
So this is why your position is against having conviction before seizure?
Yes. In our country, we have two separate, if you will, legal systems. One is the civil system, and the other is the criminal system, and they're separated. An example would be O.J. Simpson. There's very few people that don't believe that O.J. Simpson was guilty of murder, yet because the conviction required beyond a reasonable doubt, he was found not guilty. Then the family sued, and they prevailed and won $3 million in the civil suit, because the burden of proof is less. If this law was in effect for all civil cases and you had to have a conviction, there would be an example of an award that would never have come about.
We're talking with Bob Stevenson, Executive Director of the Michigan Association of Chiefs of Police, as we talk about proposed reforms to Michigan's civil asset forfeiture laws. Bob, departments, police departments in Michigan get to keep most, if not all, of what they recover. And there are a number of police chiefs in our state who have been quoted over the years saying asset forfeitures really help with the bottom line. They give departments some breathing room to purchase equipment. How do we know if police are acting under their oaths to protect and serve, or whether they need to raise revenue for their department? I mean, isn't even the suggestion of that question, doesn't that raise a crisis of confidence in whether our police have our best interest in mind?
Cynthia, I think those concerns are addressed within the law. One of the things that's required as seized assets is it be used, if you will, to supplement what the police department does, not supplant, meaning that we cannot take those dollars and plan on financing our departments with them. We have to use it for above and beyond. As an example, when I was chief in Livonia, monies that we seized went to fund the DARE program. If those funds had not been there, we would not have had a DARE program. I think that's a fair concern, but I think that the law addresses that.
How so? How does it address that?
The changes, especially the recent changes in the law that required the higher burden of proof, that required no posting a bond, there's also much greater transparency and reporting requirements that's there. And I think the transparency is always good, and that also gives the citizens the opportunity to be able to look and see exactly what their police department is doing.
What about the stories of innocent people who lose their property, never charged, either don't get it back or have to pay a lot to get it back? How do you suggest we deal with those people?
The last part of your question is pay a lot to get it back. The law's been changed. No longer do you have to post a bond to protest your property being taken or to go to court for that. I also would put forth that I think a lot of the stories that are out there are one-sided, and there's a second side to that story, and that story has not been told, and there's probably a lot more to that.
What kind of side needs to be told?
the total circumstances behind the arrest and the seizure need to be told, and those often isn't. And let me add something else. The police cannot just simply take your property. There's nothing illegal about having money and driving down the road. Before we can take your property, we have to have the same burden of proof that we do before we arrest or seize you, and that is we have to have probable cause. And that is also lost in this whole conversation, is that the police have to have probable cause to seize the property. So just possession of dollars alone is not enough to do that. And then once we seize the property with probable cause, then we have to go forward and prove our case.
This legislation being considered by the House Judiciary Committee, and I know you will be there at the hearing, it's essentially putting in better protections for citizens against seizures by their police. What reforms would you accept?
I believe that the major changes in the law afford those protections that the people are talking about, and we need to give it some time to see how it works. The major changes that have come about in the law is the elimination of the requirement to post a bond if you have had something seized from you. It has raised the evidence threshold of what the government has to prove from preponderance of the evidence to clear and convincing. And then also there's been some major changes in the reporting requirements of police departments, which will result in much greater transparency.
Are you telling us you think we're good where we're at? Let's see how it is before we tighten it up more.
Yes, we are good where we're at. We were actually good where we were before, and we've actually improved and added additional, if you will, safeguards for the citizens. But the story that needs to go forward is that property that is seized, our citizens have the opportunity and the right to protest that at no cost to themselves, and the government has to prove the case.
Bob Stevenson, Executive Director of the Michigan Association of Chiefs of Police. Bob, thank you so much for spending time with us on Stateside.
Oh, and thank you so much, Cynthia.
He died for you, and he died for me, on that dark hill of Calvary.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and it is time for another edition of Theater Talk. David Kiley of Encore Michigan is here to tell us about some offerings from professional theater companies all around the state. We're going to be kind of heavy on music this time. We're starting in Detroit's Midtown at the Fisher Music Center, right next to Orchestra Hall, the home of the Detroit Public Theater, to learn about a woman called the godmother of rock and roll.
That's right. The play is called Marie and Rosetta, and it tells the story of, you said it, the real-life godmother of rock and roll. Sister Rosetta was a pioneer in rock and roll, and is kind of often forgotten as being a huge influence from Black America. She influenced Elvis, Johnny Cash, even the Beatles. And this is a good year to do the show because she's actually nominated for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. She recorded a song called Rock Me in 1938 when jazz and American standards were still the dominant song styles in America. And you can hear how she was ahead of her time and the influences on not only the white stars and bands of the 1950s and 60s, but also the better known black artists like Chuck Berry.
Now, won't you hear me swinging? Hear the words that I'm singing. Munch my soul with water from on high.
And this play looks at the relationship between Sister Rosetta and her protege?
That's right, Marie Knight. The two were known also for recording amazing gospel, but in a style that, I'm telling you, it'll make you want to go to church every day if we could hear music like this every day in church.
Well, I really liked the tagline. I went to actually the Detroit Public Theater website, and there it was, before Elvis and Cash, there was Marie and Rosetta.
It's true. Her vocals are, and her whole style is amazing.
Now we're heading north to Rochester Hills to the Meadowbrook Theater.
That's right. And this is a show about a white singing star who I'm pretty sure was influenced by Burkitt. The show is called Tenderly, and it's about the torch singer Peggy Lee. And Lord help you if you don't know Peggy Lee's music, please. I call her a torch singer because Her ballads and her sultry style that was rooted in jazz, but occasionally drifted into the slightly rockier styles as well as gospel, melted me as a kid when I first heard her singing on The Tonight Show,
yes,
or The Old Merv Griffin Show, or in one of her own TV specials. And she's best known, of course, for her, it's practically an anthem for her, the song Fever.
Never know how much I love you. Never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a fever that's so hard to bear. You give me fever.
Now, David, is this play as tenderly about her life, or is it her songs from the 50s and 60s and kind of that jukebox style?
It is about her life, but it's her story, mm-hmm, but with the music. So if you've seen shows like Jersey Boys,
or
you know,
Carole
or
King.
Beautiful,
yeah.
Carole King, it's in that style. And, you know, before we actually talk about a few more shows,
yeah,
these music bio shows are becoming more and more popular. We've seen bio-tribute shows, as we said, to Carole King, Patsy Cline. We got the Million Dollar Quartet is out there. It's actually playing at Dexter right now, Jersey Boys. A show about Queen, a trio of shows about the Beatles, a show about Billie Holiday, Janis Joplin. It goes on and on.
Yeah.
Definitely a growing genre. Very popular with patrons, and here's why. And why I think they're a good thing. A story about a person when it's a new show is easy to get your mind around. And the music is proved, of course, so you're not like having to accept or not accept new songs. And these shows have the artists' classics interpreted by these very talented singers and actors. And for me, like anytime you can get somebody to a theater, maybe for the first time, they're going to be exposed to the other shows that theater's doing. They're going to want to come back and back. So,
case in point, I still remember the first time I saw Jersey Boys. It was in Vegas. Mm-hmm. But you know the songs, but getting all the backstory, and as you say, interpreted by today's incredibly talented young vocalists. It was pretty cool to hear things that I remember as a kid hearing on the radio sung by Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, but you see these performers from today who probably were not even around then. But
you know, next time I'm going to talk about a show coming to Ann Arbor, to Theater Nova, about the life of Bessie Smith. Same kind of show.
And as you say, it gets butts in seats.
Yes, it does.
It does indeed. Over to some plays. We're going to start at the theater company at the University of Detroit Mercy, my alma mater.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it's performed in the Bowl Theater in the downtown. 10 YMCA, which, by the way, is a great performance space, one of my favorites. This play is called A Bright New Boise, and the story is set in the break room of a craft store in Idaho. The central character has experienced a scandal at the evangelical church in his hometown, and he's now settled into this job in Boise at a Hobby Lobby. Now, this is the store best known for challenging the healthcare laws provision that said companies had to provide birth control to women employees. Ironically, he has gone to Boise to create a relationship with a son that he gave up for adoption several years earlier. This is a comedy, and obviously to me, it sounds very timely. I'm looking forward to seeing it.
And then we go to Ann Arbor's Kickshaw Theater. They always do interesting work.
They do. They have a new show opening this week called Or. So not like the canoe paddle, but okay, like the conjunction that comes after the word either.
Gotcha.
This is a period comedy set in the 1660s, but intentionally looks more like the 1960s in terms of costumes and things like that. And the play is about one night in the life of a real person, which is a poet and also a spy, and was trying to become the first real published playwright. And I talked to Kickshaw artistic director Lynn Lammers, kind of describing the story a little bit.
Or is a fast-paced comedy. It moves quickly, and it's about a real-life woman ahead of her time from the 17th century. In the play, we see that our heroine, Afra Ben, who's a real woman who lived and worked as a spy for King Charles II in the war. She's lived through this tumultuous time, this war, and now that the war has ended, we get to see her rediscover all the joys of life and remember what it was she was fighting for, namely the freedom to pursue happiness. So there's intrigue and big laughs and very sexy moments, and it's just a great play.
You know, the gist of it, from what I understand, because I'm very anxious to see it, she's trying to finish this play in one night by the morning, and she keeps getting interrupted. So it sounds like a like a broad comedy as they're telling the story. So it sounds very cool to me.
Well, an interesting collection. So the Ann Arbor's Kickshaw Theater with Orr, A Bright New Boise at the Theater Company at the University of Detroit Mercy. Meadowbrook Theater offering Tenderly, all about my mother's favorite singer, Peggy Lee. So that warms my heart. And Detroit's Midtown Theater, we have the Detroit Public Theater doing Marie and Rosetta by George Brandt. You can find out details of these and other productions. Just go to EncoreMichigan.com. David Kiley, as always, many thanks.
Thanks very much, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Still to come, should the state prohibit hospitals from ordering nurses to work overtime? The Michigan Nurses Association says yes, it should. The Michigan Health and Hospital Association says no. We'll get their take in just a few minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There's a continuing debate in Michigan and nationally about staffing levels of nurses in our hospitals and whether there is a shortage of nurses. Here in Michigan, nurse advocates and some lawmakers are pushing for the Safe Patient Care Act. Among other things, this package of bills would set up mandatory nurse-to-patient ratios and would prohibit hospitals from ordering nurses to work overtime. Now, this is certainly not a new debate. The Lansing State Journal reports that some form of legislation to address hospital staffing issues has been introduced every session since 2004. Last week, we heard from nurses who want to see changes enacted. Today, the hospital's point of view. Sam Watson is with the Michigan Health and Hospital Association, where he's Senior Vice President of Patient Safety and Quality. Welcome, Sam. Is there a shortage of nurses in Michigan?
I think the question about shortage is really broader than solely a number. What we look at in terms of staffing is the types of nurses for the different populations that our hospitals serve. So it's variable across the state.
How bad would you say the problem is from the hospital's point of view?
The challenge comes as we identify nurses for specific areas, or for example, geriatric services. There's opportunity, I think, for more nurses in that realm. We also see that a number of our members will have to use what's called agency nurses, or those are nurses that are brought in for temporary purposes. And that's a sign that there's not enough nurses to cover a specific area.
Yet the Michigan Nurses Association tells us that they don't believe there's a shortage of nurses. They say there's a shortage of nurses who are willing to work at the staffing levels and the overtime requirements of many hospitals.
Well, I'm not specifically able to speak to what they said, beyond what I see in terms of even the American Nurses Association, their publications around concerns for the decreasing numbers of nurses graduating from programs. I think one of the challenging areas is bachelor's-prepared nurses. We know that, for example, bachelor's-prepared nurses are linked with lower mortality rates in hospitals, yet there's not as many in that particular level of education as would be ideal.
That's one area that you're looking at, the associate degree nurses versus the four-year bachelor's.
Correct.
The Safe Patient Care Act would set up mandatory nurse-to-patient ratios, and it would prohibit hospitals from ordering nurses to work overtime. Why does the Michigan Health and Hospital Association oppose that Safe Patient Care Act?
Well, we look at it from the standpoint of every hospital serving a unique population needs to address the staff numbers based on the types of patients they have and the changes over the course of time. For example, if you live in northern Michigan where there may be a high tourist population in the summertime, you may have need for more nurses than you would in the winter when there's a lower number of patients that may be served. And that's in one area of the state which may be very different from another area of the state.
Am I hearing you say that this feels like one size fits all?
That's exactly it. You know, I would liken it to if the FCC put out a structure that all interviews had to be conducted by, it wouldn't give you the same opportunity to go into the depth of a subject. It's much the same in terms of staffing ratios, that one size or one set of staffing regulations wouldn't necessarily be applicable to every hospital across the state.
Well, one of the bills under consideration would give hospitals 3 to 4 years to set up staffing committees to be tasked with setting that hospital's staffing plans, and these committees would have to include nurses.
In many cases, the hospitals already have an approach to staffing. They work with their nurses collaboratively. Organizations have what's called the chief nursing officer, who is the nurse responsible for the nursing staff within the organization, as well as various other participants in the decision-making process. Looking at acuity of the patients, for example, and the skill mix of the nurses that are in that organization.
How many of the hospitals that you represent have a firm mechanism in place that would include input from the rank and file nurses in staffing decisions?
That's a great question. And actually, I can't give you a specific number across 134 hospitals. It's in terms of how many actually have a specific, as you're describing, process in place.
How much do budgetary concerns figure into a hospital's decision regarding staffing levels and requirements that nurses work overtime?
Well, you know, I think from a budgetary standpoint, that's something that we have to consider across all parts of a hospital's operation, or actually any organization for that matter. You know, one of the things that you mentioned earlier, the question about shortages, bringing in agency nurses, for example, is very expensive. We'd much rather have staff that are full-time, regular employees of an organization. So that actually keeps costs more manageable. In terms of using it to set numbers of staff, you know, I think it's really much more about the acuity of the patients and the ebb and flow of patient numbers.
What steps do hospitals take, Sam, before they go to the mandatory overtime route?
The first thing that will happen is they'll ask for volunteers. I come from a laboratory background, and that would be something we would do. If you had a shortage on a given shift, you'd ask for volunteers first and foremost. That's always the preferred way of approaching this.
The people who are providing that bedside nursing care tell us that they're being ordered to work overtime shifts, sometimes 18 hours straight, and that they have too many patients to care for to provide what they feel is the best care. And when they try to make a case to supervisors or administrators, they're being told basically just do the best you can. What are patients supposed to think?
Well, you know, I'm not able to speak to any specific circumstance, but seeing organizations, and actually we recently published on this, where leadership is involved in the dialogue on a regular basis with the staff, where they do what's called a walk around. That is, senior leadership comes through, they talk with staff, they understand the issues, and then bring those issues back for resolution. We see that, one, you have much less risk of staff burnout, you see better patient care, much better outcomes. So, you know, I think from a patient standpoint, that also means engaging patients in conversations about their care and understanding what their needs are. And so that's part of the care plan, much the same dialogue as I just described with leadership.
But when you have nurses saying we can't do that because we have more patients than the ideal RN patient ratio, how are they supposed to do that?
Well, yeah, I'm not really sure what an ideal ratio would be, but there are peaks and valleys. And I think, for example, we're hopefully coming out of a pretty intense flu season. And when I talk with physicians, nurses, hospital leaders around the state, there are peaks at certain times of the year. And I think we all, even in our work outside of the clinical setting, see those sorts of peaks. But that's not a constant circumstance.
I'm speaking with Sam Watson of the Michigan Health and Hospital Association. Another bill, Sam, in the state legislature would require just simply that actual staffing ratios be made available to Department of Health and Human Services, to nurses, and to the public. Why is that a bad idea for the public to know just how much each hospital is staffed so they have that information to help them make a well-informed decision about where to seek treatment?
You know, that's a great question. In fact, just in this past month, actually, we're in February now, in January, we just launched a transparency website, a refresh of a transparency website called Verify My Care, where we're putting very specific outcome data for the public to see, infection rates, mortality data. you know, when you get into very operational items like staffing numbers, one, it's really challenging to capture that data and make it meaningful. You know, there's unfortunately, when you have any data submissions, there's always a lag time. So is that really pertinent in decision making or not? It's a fair question. I think it would be a challenge to try to get complete, accurate information, which may not be helpful.
Is it because patient and nurse ratios change each day? I mean, when you talk about it being fluid?
Yeah, as acuity of the patients change on a daily basis, as the number of patients change, refreshing that data would actually be pretty cumbersome. And again, I don't know how useful that would be from a decision-making standpoint by a consumer.
We got a number of emails from nurses about this issue, the Safe Patient Care Act. I'm going to read you a bit of just one. I'd like your reaction. So she writes, and I'm quoting here, the bottom line is, and she puts $6 signs, if the hospital is not locally owned, invested in the community it serves, the chances of poor staffing and all-around bad management decisions increase. If management will not support nurses, then our lawmakers must. How do you respond to that, nurse?
Well, I would say first and foremost, the hospitals around the state of Michigan all have local boards. So while they may be part of a healthcare system, there are a group of community leaders that sit on a board that oversees that hospital. So decisions are made very close to the community. In fact, they're made in the community. I don't know her specific circumstance she's speaking to, but from what I've seen, in fact, I've been at a number of hospital board retreats recently, that the number one issue is patient safety in that community, and they're looking at how to improve it.
Are those local boards making the staffing decisions, Sam?
Staffing decisions and operational elements, so that's not something directly in purview of the board, but the board is concerned about the security and safety of patients in their community. So at a more of a global level, they're looking at, you know, what are our patient expectations? What are our patient satisfaction scores look like? What are our outcomes? And are able to ask leadership, how are you addressing those issues? And that drives right down to the person at the bedside caring for a patient.
Sam, if a nurse with talent and experience has a choice, go to a hospital where they may be forced to work those long mandatory overtime shifts, or go to a clinic or another facility where they wouldn't, what would you say to that nurse to encourage that nurse to go the hospital route?
I would say, first of all, your choices of where you choose to work are very personal, and it's linked to your individual mission as a provider. All of us go into healthcare for one reason, that's to care for others. And so there's a myriad of things that you have to take into consideration. You know, if you work afternoons or nights or weekends, there's a whole collection of things that go into that decision-making process. So I think a person has to look at the totality of the work-life balance and make decisions based on that.
There does seem to be this great impasse between hospitals and the nurses who are providing that bedside care for the patients who come to your hospitals, not just in Michigan, but this is nationally. Nurses are working so hard to get either state or federally mandated RN ratios, ones that they say are safer. So what do you see as the way through this impasse?
I think the first and most important thing is dialogue between nurses, their leadership, to understand how do you, one, provide the safest care possible. That's first and foremost for any organization, any provider. The second is understanding what are those things that contribute to increasing the safety and quality of care. I mentioned earlier the walkarounds. Our history in Michigan has long been, we've seen this replicated across the country, where if you're focusing on providing care, you're allowing the free flow of information around the best care guidelines and allowing the staff at the local level to implement care in a fashion that meets the needs of their patients, staying true to whatever evidence is out there, you can achieve that. And that is always, as for our experience, been through open dialogue with nursing, with physicians, with leadership, and all the other parts of the care team.
When we say leadership, are you also, certainly you're talking about the nursing supervisors in that chain, but that does this also include hospital administration?
It does. In fact, you know, I mentioned previously, we've looked very carefully at safety culture data, So what is perception of the safety of an organization by any given nurse, pharmacist, physician, and what we call walk rounds, that is, where there's active discussion with senior leadership, chief executive officer, chief nursing officer, even chief financial officer, and having those conversations with people at the bedside about what are the pebbles in their shoes and how do you make it better.
As the public hears, you know, nurses describing incidents where patients are hurt because somebody just had too many patients, I think it leaves the public going, I don't know what to think, except there seems to be a real sense of dissatisfaction and unhappiness among those nurses who are taking care of me.
Well, first of all, we're seeing that across Michigan as well as across the nation, we're seeing the numbers of patients injured in result of medical error decreasing. There's been a lot of effort, and a lot of it has been by nurses at the bedside implementing evidence-based best practice to drive down the risk of harm to patients. You know, there's just the ongoing, I guess, dynamicism would be the word in healthcare. It's a pretty challenging place to be for anybody in healthcare today because of the uncertainty at all levels. And so those all have influences. And I think it's, again, back to the dialogue, having the issues and concerns by the nursing staff raised and having that that heard and responded to by leadership. And when that happens, we see that the outcomes are positive.
Is there anything that could be done to that Safe Patient Care Act that would allow the Michigan Health and Hospital Association to say, all right, we're on board with that?
So from that perspective, I don't live in the realm of advocacy myself. My mission is all about helping our members achieve safe care. So I really would look to others to speak to what sort of changes, if any, could be made. But at this point in time, the way that that legislation is written, we have concerns about its limitations and impact on organizations and their nursing staff to be able to truly affect what needs to be done at the local level.
Sam Watson is Senior Vice President of Patient Safety and Quality for the Michigan Health and Hospital Association. Sam Watson, thank you so much for taking time with us on Stateside.
Thank you. Really appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Winter in Michigan means we spend a lot of time indoors, away from bright light, sunshine. Michigan State University neuroscientists have found that spending too much time in dim light can actually change the structure of the brain in the area called the hippocampus, and that affects learning and memory. It's the first study to make this connection. The study was done on Nile grass rats, which, like us, sleep at night. So results could apply to our brains as well. But co-investigator Tony Nunez says this is something we can reverse.
We found that after dim lights had produced these dramatic changes in the brain, if we took these animals and put them back on bright lights for 4 weeks, they recover. They were smart again.
What to do? Begin by looking at your home and office light.
Make your lights bright and go outside whenever the sun is shining. And if you live in Michigan, save some money and go to Florida every so often.
And that's our program for today. Our Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Joey Horan, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so very much for listening.